Thomas thought out what he wanted to say, and then he continued, "If I ever tell you the bad thing's coming, and I tell you to run, don't just stand around like a dumb person. Just run." Derek stared at him, thinking about it, still smiling. Then after a while he said, "Sure, okay. Promise? Promise. But what's a bad thing? I don't really know for sure, but I'll feel when it's coming, I think, and tell you, and you'll run."
"Where?"
"Anywhere. Down the hall, find some aides. Stay with them."
"Sure.
You better wash. Breakfast soon. Maybe sticky buns." Thomas unwrapped himself from the blanket and got out of bed. He stepped into his slippers again and walked to the bathroom. Just as Thomas was opening the bathroom door, Derek said, "You mean that breakfast?"
Thomas turned.
"Huh? You mean a bad thing might come at breakfast?"
"Might," Thomas said.
"Could it be poached eggs?"
"Huh?"
"The bad thing. Could it be poached eggs? I don't like poached eggs. Oh, slimy, yuck. That'd be real bad, not good at all, like cereal and bananas and sticky buns."
"No, no," Thomas said. "The bad thing isn't poached eggs. It's a person, some funny, weird person. I'll feel it coming and tell you, and you'll run."
Oh, sure, a person."
Thomas went into the bathroom, closed the door. He didn't have much beard. He had an electric razor, but he only used it a couple of times a month. And today, he didn't need it. He brushed his teeth, though, and he peed. He made the water start in the shower. Only then did he let himself laugh, because enough time had passed so Derek wouldn't even wonder if Thomas was laughing at him. Poached eggs. Though Thomas usually didn't like seeing himself, seeing how lumpy and wrong and dumb his face was, he peeked at the steam-streaked mirror. One time, long ago, past when he could remember, he'd been laughing when he'd happened to see himself in a mirror, and for once, surprise, he hadn't felt so bad about how he looked. When he laughed, he looked more like a normal person. Just pretending to laugh didn't make him look more normal. It had to be real laughing, and smiling didn't do it either, because a smile wasn't enough of a laugh to change his face. In fact, a smile could sometimes look so sad, he couldn't stand seeing himself at all. Poached eggs. Thomas shook his head, and when his laughter finished, he turned from the mirror. To Derek, the most worst bad thing he could think of was poached eggs and no sticky buns. Which was very funny, ha-ha. You try to tell Derek about walking dead people and scissors sticking out of bellies and something that eats little live animals, and old Derek would look at you and smile and nod and not get it at all. For as long as he could remember, Thomas had wished he was a normal person, not dumb. And many times he thanked God for at least making him not as dumb as poor Derek. But now he half wished he was dumber, so he could get those ugly, nasty vision pictures out of his mind, so he could forget about Derek going to die and the bad thing coming and Julie being in danger. So he'd have nothing to worry about except poached eggs, which wouldn't be much of a worry at all, since he sort of liked poached eggs.
When Clint Karagiosis arrived at Dakota and Dakota shortly before 9 o'clock, Bobby took him by the shoulder, turned him around, and went back to the elevators with him. "You drive, and I'll fill you in on what's happened during the night. I know you've got other cases to attend to, but the Pollard thing's getting hotter by the minute. Where are we going?"
"First, Palomar Labs, they called. Test results are ready."
Only a few clouds remained in the sky, and they were all far off toward the mountains, moving away like the billowing sails of great galleons on an eastward journey. It was a quintessential Southern California day. Blue, pleasantly warm, everything green and fresh, and rush hour traffic so hideously snarled that it could transform an ordinary citizen into a foaming-at-the-mouth sociopath with a yearning to pull the trigger of a semi-automatic weapon. Clint avoided freeways, but even surface streets were clogged. By the time Bobby recounted everything that had transpired since they had seen each other yesterday afternoon, they were still 10 minutes from Palomar, in spite of the questions occasioned by Clint's amazement, subdued like all of his reactions, but amazement nonetheless over the discovery that Frank was evidently able to teleport himself. Finally, Bobby changed the subject, because talking too much about psychic phenomena to a phlegmatic guy like Clint made him feel like an airhead, as if he had lost his grip on reality. While they inched along Bristol Avenue, he said, "I can remember when you could go anywhere in Orange County and never get caught in traffic. Not so long ago. I remember when you didn't have to sign a developer's waiting list to buy a house. Demand wasn't 5 times supply." "Yeah. And I remember when orange groves were all over Orange County." "Me too," Bobby sighed. "Well, hell, listen to me like an old geezer babbling about the good old days. Pretty soon I'll be talking about how nice it was when there were still dinosaurs around." "Dreams," Clint said. "Everyone's got a dream, and the one more people have than any other is the California dream. So they never stop coming. Even though so many have come now that the dream isn't really quite attainable anymore. Not the original dream that started it all. Of course, maybe a dream should be unattainable, or at least at the outer limits of your reach. If it's too easy, it's meaningless." Bobby was surprised by the long burst of words from Clint, but more surprised to hear the man talking about something as intangible as dreams. "You're already a Californian, so what's your dream?" After a brief hesitation, Clint said, "That Felina will be able to hear someday. There are so many medical advancements these days, new discoveries and treatments and techniques all the time." As Clint turned left off Bristol onto the side street where Palomar Laboratory stood, Bobby decided that was a good dream. A damned fine dream, maybe even better than his and Julie's dream, about buying time and getting a chance to bring Thomas out of Cielo Vista and into a remade family. They parked in the lot beside the huge concrete block building in which Palomar Laboratories was housed. As they were walking toward the front door, Clint said, by the way, the receptionist here thinks I'm gay, which is fine with me." "What?" Clint went inside without saying more, and Bobby followed him to the reception window. An attractive blonde sat at the counter. "Hi, Lisa," Clint said. "Hi," she punctuated her response by cracking her chewing gum. "Dakota and Dakota." "I remember," she said. "Your stuff's ready. I'll get it." She glanced at Bobby and smiled, and he smiled too, though her expression seemed a little peculiar to him. When she returned with 2 large sealed manila envelopes, one labeled samples and the other analyses, Clint handed the second one to Bobby. They stepped to one side of the lounge away from the counter. Bobby tore open the envelope and skimmed the documents inside. "Cat's blood."
"You serious?"
"Yeah. When Frank woke up in that motel, he was covered with cat's blood." "I knew he was no killer," Bobby said. "The cat may have an opinion about that."
The other stuff is?
Well, a bunch of technical terms here, but what it comes down to is that it's what it looks like, black sand." Stepping back to the reception counter, Clint said, "Lisa, you remember we talked about a black sand beach in Hawaii?"
"Kaimu,"
she said. "It's a dynamite place." "Yeah, Kaimu. Is it the only one?"
"Black sand beach, you mean?"
"No, there's Punalu, which is a real sweet place, too. Those are on the big island. I guess there must be more on the other islands, because there's volcanoes all over the place, aren't there?" Bobby joined them at the counter.
What do volcanoes have to do with it?"
Lisa took her chewing gum out of her mouth and put it aside on a piece of paper. Well, the way I heard it, really hot lava flows into the sea, and when it meets the water, there are these huge explosions which throw off zillions and zillions of these really teeny tiny beads of black glass. And then over a long period of time, the waves rub all the beads together until they're ground down into sand. They have these beaches anywhere but Hawaii? Bobby wondered. She shrugged. Probably. Clint, is this fella your, friend?
Yeah, Clint said.
I mean, you know, your good friend?
Yeah, Clint said without looking at Bobby.
Lisa winked at Bobby. Listen, you make Clint take you to Kaimu, because I'll tell you something. It's really terrific to go out on a black beach at night and make love under the stars, because it's soft, for one thing, but mainly because black sand doesn't reflect moonlight like regular sand. It seems like you're floating in space, darkness all around. It really sharpens your senses, if you know what I mean.
It sounds terrific, Clint said.
Take care, Lisa. He headed for the door. As Bobby turned to follow Clint, Lisa said, You make him take you to Kaimu, you hear? You'll have a good time.
Outside, Bobby said, Clint, you've got some explaining to do.
Didn't you hear her?
These little beads of black glass.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Hey, look at you. You're grinning.
I don't think I've ever seen you grinning. I don't think I like you grinning.
By 9 o'clock, Lee Chen had arrived at the offices, opened a bottle of orange-flavored seltzer, and settled in the computer room midst his beloved hardware, where Julie was waiting for him. He was 5'6", slender but wiry, with a warm brass complexion and jet-black hair that bristled in a modified punk style. He wore red tennis shoes and socks, baggy black cotton pants with a white belt, a black and charcoal-gray shirt with a subtle leaf pattern, and a black jacket with narrow lapels and big shoulder pads. He was the most stylishly dressed employee at Dakota & Dakota, even compared to Cassie Hanley, their receptionist, who was an unashamed clothes horse. While Lee sat in front of his computers sipping seltzer, Julie filled him in on what had happened at the hospital and showed him the printouts of the information Bobby had acquired earlier that morning. Frank Pollard sat with them in the third chair, where Julie could keep an eye on him. Throughout their conversation, Lee exhibited no surprise at what he was being told, as if his computers had bestowed on him such enormous wisdom and foresight that nothing, not even a man capable of teleportation, could surprise him. Julie knew that Lee, as well as everyone else in the Dakota & Dakota family, would never leak a word of any client's business to anyone. But she didn't know how much of his super-cool demeanor was real and how much was a conscious image that he put on every morning with his ultra-voguish clothes. Though his unshakable nonchalance might be partly feigned, his talent for computers was unquestionably real. When Julie had finished her condensed version of recent events, Lee said, "Okay, what do you need from me now?" There was no doubt on either his part or hers that eventually he could provide whatever she required. She gave him a stenopad. Double rows of currency serial numbers filled the first 10 pages. Those are random samplings of the bills in each of the bags of cash we're holding for Frank. Now, can you find out if it's hot money, stolen? Maybe an extortion or ransom payment? Lee quickly paged through the lists. No consecutive numbers. That makes it harder. Usually cops don't have a record of the serial numbers of stolen money unless it was brand new bills, which are still bound in packets consecutively numbered right off the press. Most of this cash is fairly well circulated. There's an outside chance it might still be from a ransom or extortion payoff, like you said. The cops would have taken down all the numbers before they let the victim make the drop, just in case the perp made a clean getaway. It looks bleak, but I'll try. What else? Julie said, an entire family in Garden Grove, last name Ferris, was murdered last year. Because of me, Frank said. Lee propped his elbows on the arms of his chair, leaned back and steepled his fingers. He looked like a wise Zen master who had been forced to don the clothes of an avant-garde artist after getting the wrong suitcase at the airport. No one really dies, Mr. Pollard. They just go on from here. Grief is good, but guilt is pointless. Though she knew too few computer fanatics to be certain, Julie suspected that not many found a way to combine the hard realities of science and technology with religion. But in fact, Lee had arrived at a belief in God through his work with computers and his interest in modern physics. He once explained to her why a profound understanding of the dimensionless space inside a computer network, combined with a modern physicist's view of the universe, led inevitably to faith in a creator. But she hadn't followed a thing he'd said. She gave Lee Chen the dates and details of the Ferris and Roman murders. "We think they were all killed by the same man. I haven't got a clue as to his real name, so I call him Mr. Blue. Considering the savagery of the murders, we suspect he's a serial killer with a long list of victims. If we're right, the murders have been so widely spread, or Mr. Blue has covered his tracks so well, that the press has never made connections between the crimes. Otherwise," Frank said, "they'd have sensationalized it on the front pages, especially if this guy regularly bites his victims." "But since most police agencies are computer-linked these days," Julie said, "they might have made connections across jurisdictions. Saw what the press didn't. There might be one or more quiet, ongoing investigations between local, state, and federal authorities. We need to know if any police in California or the FBI nationally are onto Mr. Blue, and we need to know anything they've learned about him, no matter how trivial." Lee smiled. In the middle of his brass-hued face, his teeth were like pegs of highly polished ivory. "That means going past the public access files in their computers. I'll have to break their security, one agency after another, all the way into the FBI." "Difficult?" "Very. But I'm not without experience." He pushed his jacket sleeves further up on his arms, flexed his fingers, and turned to the terminal keyboard, as if he were a concert pianist about to interpret Mozart. He hesitated and glanced sideways at Julie. "I'll work into their systems indirectly to discourage tracebacks. I won't damage any data or breach national security, so I probably won't even be noticed. But if someone spots me snooping and puts a tracer on me that I don't see or can't shake, they might pull your PI license for this." "Well, I'll sacrifice myself, take the blame. Bobby's license won't be pulled, too, so the agency won't go down." How long will this take?" "Oh, 4, 5 hours. Maybe more. Maybe a lot more. Can somebody bring me lunch at noon? I'd rather eat here and not take a break." "Sure. What would you like?" "Big Mac, double order fries, vanilla shake." Julie grimaced. "How come a high-tech guy like you never heard of cholesterol?" "Heard of it. Don't care. If we never really die, cholesterol can't kill me. It can only move me out of this life a little sooner."
Archer Van Corvair cracked open the Levalore blind and peered through the thick bulletproof glass in the front door of his Newport Beach shop. He squinted suspiciously at Bobby and Clint, though he knew and expected them. At last he unlocked the door and let them in. Van Corvair was about 55, but invested a lot of time and money in the maintenance of a youthful appearance. To thwart time, he had undergone dermabrasion, facelifts, and liposuction. To improve on nature, he'd had a nose job, cheek implants, and chin restructuring. He wore a toupee of such exquisite craftsmanship it would have passed for his own dyed black hair, except that he sabotaged the illusion by insisting on not merely a replacement, but a lush, unnatural pompadour. If he ever got into a swimming pool wearing that toupee, it would look like the conning tower of a submarine. After re-engaging both deadbolts, he turned to Bobby.
"I never do business in the morning. I only take afternoon appointments."
"We appreciate the exception you've made for us," Bobby said. Van Corvair sighed elaborately.
"Well, what is it?"
"I have a stone I'd like you to appraise for me." He squinted, which wasn't appealing since his eyes were already as narrow as those of a ferret. Before his name change, 30 years ago, he'd been Jim Bob Spleener, and a friend would have told him that when he squinted suspiciously, he looked very much like a Spleener and not at all like a Van Corvair.
"An appraisal? That's all you want?
He led them through the small but plush sales room. Hand-textured plaster ceiling, bleached suede walls, whitewashed oak floors, custom area carpet by Patterson. Flynn and Martin in shades of peach, pale blue, and sandstone. A modern white sofa flanked by pickled Finnish burlwood tables by Bao. Four elegant rattan chairs encircling the round table with a glass top thick enough to survive a blow from a sledgehammer. One small merchandise display case stood off to the left. Van Corvair's business was conducted entirely by appointment. His jewelry was custom designed for the very rich and tasteless, people who would find it necessary to buy $100,000 necklaces to wear to a $1,000 a plate charity dinner and never grasp the irony. The back wall was mirrored, and Van Corvair watched himself with obvious pleasure all the way across the room. He hardly took his eyes off his reflection until he passed through the door into the workroom. Bobby wondered if the guy ever got so entranced by his image that he walked smack into it. He didn't like Jim Bob Van Corvair, but the narcissistic creep's knowledge of gems and jewelry was often useful. Years ago, when Dakota and Dakota Investigations was just Dakota Investigations, without the ampersand and the redundancy, better never put it that way around Julie, who would appreciate the clever wordplay but would make him eat the redundancy part. Bobby had helped Van Corvair recover a fortune in unmounted diamonds stolen by a lover. Old Jim Bob desperately wanted his gems but didn't want the woman sent to prison, so he went to Bobby instead of to the police. That was the only soft spot Bobby had ever seen in Van Corvair. In the intervening years, the jeweler no doubt had grown a callous over it, too. Bobby fished one of the marble-sized red stones from his pocket. He saw the jeweler's eyes widen. With Clint standing to one side of him, with Bobby behind him and looking over his shoulder, Van Corvair sat on a high stool at a workbench and examined the rough-cut stone through a loop. Then he put it on the lighted glass table of a microscope and studied it with that more powerful instrument. Well? Bobby asked. The jeweler did not respond. He rose, elbowing them out of the way, and went to another stool farther along the workbench. There, he used one scale to weigh the stone, and another to determine if its specific gravity matched that of any known gems. Finally, he moved to a third stool that was positioned in front of a vise, and from a drawer he withdrew a ring box in which three large cut gems lay on a square of blue velvet.
"Junk diamonds," he said.
"They look nice to me," Bobby said.
"Too many flaws."
He selected one of those stones and fixed it in the vise with a couple of turns of the crank. Gripping the red beauty in a small pair of pliers, he used one of its sharper edges to attempt to score the polished facet of the diamond in the vise, pressing with considerable effort. Then he put the pliers and red gem aside, picked up another jeweler's loop, leaned forward, and studied the junk diamond.
"A faint scratch," he said. "Diamond cuts diamond."
He held the red stone between thumb and forefinger, staring at it with obvious fascination and greed.
"Where did you get this?"
"Can't tell you," Bobby said. "So it's just a red diamond?"
"Just. The red diamond may be the rarest precious stone in the world. You must let me market it for you. I have clients who'd pay anything to have this as the center stone of a necklace or a pendant. It'll probably be too big for a ring even after final cut. It's huge."
"What's it worth?" Clint asked.
Impossible to say until it's finished cut. Millions, certainly."
"Millions?" Bobby said doubtfully. "It's big, but not that big." Van Corvair finally tore his gaze from the stone and looked up at Bobby.
"You don't understand. Until now, there were only 7 known red diamonds in the world. This is the 8th, and when it's cut and polished, it'll be one of the 2 largest. This comes as close to priceless as anything gets."
Outside Archer Van Corvair's small shop, where heavy traffic roared past on Pacific Coast Highway, with disco frenetic flares of sunlight flashing off the chrome and glass. It was hard to believe that the tranquility of Newport Harbor and its burden of beautiful yachts were just beyond the buildings on the far side of the street. In a sudden moment of enlightenment, Bobby realized that his entire life, and perhaps nearly everyone else's, was like this street at this precise point in time. All bustle and noise, glare and movement, a desperate rush to break out of the herd, to achieve something and transcend the frantic whirl of commerce, thereby earning respite for reflection and a shot at serenity, when all the time serenity was only a few steps away on the far side of the street, just out of sight. That realization contributed to a heretofore subtle feeling that the Pollard case was somehow a trap, or more accurately, a squirrel cage that spun faster and faster even as he scampered frantically to get a footing on its rotating floor. He stood for a few seconds by the open door of the car, feeling ensnared, caged. At that moment, he was not sure why, in spite of the obvious dangers, he had been so eager to take on Frank's problems and put all that he cared about at risk. He knew now that the reasons he had quoted to Julie and to himself, sympathy for Frank, curiosity, the excitement of a wildly different kind of job, were merely justifications, not reasons, and that his true motivation was something he did not yet understand. Unnerved, he got in the car and pulled the door shut as Clint started the engine. "Bobby, how many red diamonds would you say are in the mason jar? 100? More, a couple hundred. Worth what, hundreds of millions? Maybe a billion or more." They stared at each other, and for a while neither of them spoke. It wasn't that no words were adequate to the situation. Instead, there was too much to say, and no easy way to determine where to begin. At last Bobby said, "But you couldn't convert the stones to cash. Not quickly, anyway. You'd have to dribble them onto the market over a lot of years to prevent a sudden dilution of their rarity and value, but also to avoid causing a sensation, drawing unwanted attention, and maybe having to answer some unanswerable questions. After they've mined diamonds for hundreds of years all over the world and only found 7 red ones, where the hell did Frank come up with a jar full?" Bobby shook his head and said nothing. Clint reached into his pants pocket and withdrew one of the diamonds, smaller than the specimen that Bobby had brought for Archer Van Corver's appraisal. "I took this home to show it to Felina. I was going to return it to the jar when I got to the office, but you hustled me out before I had a chance. Now that I know what it is, I don't want it in my possession a minute longer." Bobby took the stone and put it in his pocket with the larger diamond. "Thank you, Clint." Dr. Dyson Manfred's study, in his house in Turtle Rock, was the most uncomfortable place Bobby had ever been. He had been happier last week, flattened on the floor of his van, trying to avoid being chopped to bits by automatic weapons fire, than he was among Manfred's collection of many-legged, carapaced, antenna-bristled, mandibled, and thoroughly repulsive exotic bugs. Repeatedly, in his peripheral vision, Bobby saw something move in one of the many glass-covered boxes on the wall, but every time he turned to ascertain which hideous creature was about to slip out from under the frame, his fear proved unfounded. All of the nightmarish specimens were pinned and motionless, lined up neatly beside one another, none missing. He also would have sworn that he heard things skittering and slithering inside the shallow drawers of the many cases that he knew contained more insects, but he supposed that those sounds were every bit as imaginary as a phantom movement glimpsed from the corners of his eyes. Though he knew Clint to be a born stoic, Bobby was impressed by the apparent ease with which the guy endured the creepy-crawly decor. This was an employee he must never lose. He decided on the spot to give Clint a significant raise in salary before the day was out. Bobby found Dr. Manfred nearly as disquieting as his collection. The tall, thin, long-limbed entomologist seemed to be the offspring of a professional basketball player and one of those African stick insects that you saw in nature films and hope never to encounter in real life. Manfred stood behind his desk, his chair pushed out of the way, and they stood in front of it. Their attention was directed upon a 2-foot-long, 1-foot-wide, white enamel, inch-deep lab tray, which occupied the center of the desktop and over which was draped a small white towel.
"I have had no sleep since Mr. Karagiosis brought this to me last night," Manfred said. "And I won't sleep much tonight either, just turning over all the remaining questions in my mind. This dissection was the most fascinating of my career, and, well, I doubt I'll ever again experience anything in my life to equal it."
The intensity with which Manfred spoke, and the implication that neither good food nor good sex, neither a beautiful sunset nor a fine wine, could be a fraction as satisfying as insect dismemberment, gave Bobby a queasy stomach. He glanced at the fourth man in the room, if only to divert his attention briefly from their bugglefile host. The guy was in his late 40s, as round as Manfred was angular, as pink as Manfred was pale, with red-gold hair, blue eyes, and freckles. He sat on a chair in the corner, straining the seams of his gray jogging suit, with his hands fisted on his heavy thighs, looking like a good Boston Irish fellow who had been trying to eat his way into a career as a sumo wrestler. The entomologist hadn't introduced or even referred to the well-padded observer. Bobby figured that introductions would be made when Manfred was ready. He decided not to force the issue, if only because the round man silently regarded them with a mixture of wonder, suspicion, fear, and intense curiosity that encouraged Bobby to believe that they would not be pleased to hear what he had to tell them when, at last, he spoke. With long-fingered, spidery hands which Bobby might have sprayed with Raid, if he'd had any, Dyson Manfred removed the towel from the white enamel tray, revealing the remains of Frank's insect. The head, a couple of the legs, one of the highly articulated pincers, and a few other unidentifiable parts had been cut off and put aside. Each grisly piece rested on a soft pad of what appeared to be cotton cloth, almost as a jeweler might present a fine gem on velvet to a prospective buyer. Bobby stared at the plum-sized head with its small reddish-blue eye, then at its two large, muddy yellow eyes that were too similar in color to Dyson Manfred's. He shivered. The main part of the bug was in the middle of the tray, on its back. The exposed underside had been slid open, the outer layers of tissue removed or folded back, and the inner workings revealed. Using the gleaming point of a slender scalpel, which he handled with grace and precision, the entomologist began by showing them the respiratory, ingestive, digestive, and excretory systems of the bug. Manfred kept referring to the great art of the biological design, but Bobby saw nothing that equaled a painting by Matisse. In fact, the guts of the thing were even more repellent than its exterior. One term, polishing chamber, struck him as odd, but when he asked for a further explanation, Manfred only said, in time, and went on with his lecture. When the entomologist finished, Bobby said, "Okay, we know how the thing ticks, so what does that tell us about it that we might want to know? For instance, where does it come from?" Manfred stared at him, unresponding. Bobby said, "The South American jungles?" Manfred's peculiar amber eyes were hard to read, and his silence puzzling. "Africa?" Bobby said. The entomologist's stare was beginning to make him twitchier than he already was. "Mr. Dakota," Manfred said finally, "you're asking the wrong question. Let me ask the interesting ones for you. What does this creature eat? Well, to put it in the simplest terms that any layman can understand, it eats a broad spectrum of minerals, rock, and soil. What does it ex—"
"It eats dirt?" Clint asked.
"That's an even simpler way to express it," Manfred said. "Not precise, mind you, but simpler. We don't yet understand how it breaks down those substances or how it obtains energy from them. There are aspects of its biology that we can see perfectly clearly, but that still remain mysterious.
I thought insects ate plants or each other or dead meat, Bobby said.
They do, the entomologist confirmed. This thing is not an insect, or any other class of the phylum Arthropoda, for that matter.
Sure looks like an insect to me, Bobby said, glancing down at the partly dismantled bug and grimacing involuntarily.
No, Manfred said. This is a creature that evidently bores through soil and stone, capable of ingesting that material in chunks as large as fat grapes. And the next question is, if that's what it eats, what does it excrete? And the answer, Mr. Dakota, is that it excretes diamonds.
Bobby jerked as if the entomologist had hit him. He glanced at Clint, who looked as surprised as Bobby felt. The Pollard case had induced several changes in the Greek, and now it had robbed him of his poker face. In a tone of voice that suggested Manfred was playing them for fools, Clint said, "You're telling us it turns dirt into diamonds?"
"No, no," Manfred said. "It methodically eats through veins of diamond-bearing carbon and other material until it finds the gems. Then it swallows them in their encrusted jackets of minerals, digests those minerals, passes the rough diamond into the polishing chamber, where any remaining extraneous matter is worn away by a vigorous contact with these hundreds of fine wire-like bristles that line the chamber."
With the scalpel, he pointed to the feature of the bug that he had just described.
"Then it squirts the raw diamond out the other end."
The entomologist opened the center drawer of his desk, removed a white handkerchief, unfolded it, and revealed three red diamonds, all considerably smaller than the one Bobby had taken to Van Corver, but probably worth hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, apiece.
"I found these at various points in the creature's system."
The largest of the three was still partially encased in a mottled brown-black-gray mineral crust. "They're diamonds?" Bobby said, playing ignorant. "I've never seen red diamonds."
Neither had I, so I went to another professor, a geologist, who happens to be a gemologist as well. Got him out of bed at midnight to show these to him.
Bobby glanced at the would-be Irish sumo wrestler. But the man did not rise from his chair or speak, so he evidently was not the geologist. Manfred explained what Bobby and Clint already knew, that these scarlet diamonds were among the rarest things on earth, while they pretended that it was all news to them.
"This discovery strengthened my suspicions about the creature, so I went straight to Dr. Gavinall's house and woke him shortly before 2 o'clock this morning. He threw on sweats and sneakers, and we came right back here, and we've been here ever since, working this out together, unable to believe our own eyes."
At last, the round man rose and stepped to the side of the desk.
"Roger Gavinall," Manfred said by way of introduction. "Roger is a geneticist, a specialist in recombinant DNA, and widely known for his creative projections of macro-scale genetic engineering that might conceivably progress from current knowledge."
"Sorry," Bobby said. "I lost you at Roger is. We'll need some more of that layman's language, I'm afraid."
"I'm a geneticist and futurist," Gavinall said. His voice was unexpectedly melodic, like that of a television game show host. "Most genetic engineering for the foreseeable future will take place on a microscopic scale, creating new and useful bacteria, repairing flawed genes in the cells of human beings to correct inherited weaknesses and prevent inherited disease. But eventually, we'll be able to create whole new species of animals and insects. Macro-scale engineering. Useful things like voracious mosquito eaters. It'll eliminate the need to spray malathion in tropical regions like Florida. Cows that are maybe half the size of today's cows, and, well, a lot more metabolically efficient, so they require less food, yet produce twice as much milk."
Bobby wanted to suggest that Gavinal consider combining the two biological inventions to produce a small cow that ate only enormous quantities of mosquitoes and produced three times as much milk, but he kept his mouth shut, certain that neither of the scientists would appreciate his humor. Anyway, he had to admit that his compulsion to make a joke of this was an attempt to deal with his own deep-seated fear of the ever-increasing weirdness of the Pollard case.
This thing, Gavinal said, indicating the deconstructed bug in the lab tray, this thing isn't anything that nature created. It's clearly an engineered life form, so astonishingly task-specific in every aspect of its biology that it's essentially a biological machine, a diamond scavenger.
Using a pair of forceps and a scalpel, Dyson Manfred gently turned over the insect that wasn't an insect, so they could see its midnight black shell rimmed with red markings. Bobby thought he heard whispery movement in many parts of the study, and he wished Manfred would let some sunlight into the room. The windows were covered with interior wood shutters, and the slats were tightly shut. Bugs liked darkness and shadows, and the lamps here seemed insufficiently bright to dissuade them from scurrying out of the shallow drawers over Bobby's shoes, up his socks, and under the legs of his pants. Hanging his pendulous belly over the desk, indicating the crimson edging on the carapace, Gavinal said,
"On the hunch Dyson and I shared, we showed a representation of this pattern to an associate in the mathematics department, and he confirmed that it's an obvious binary code."
"Like the universal product code that's on everything you buy at the grocery store," the entomologist explained.
Clint said, "You mean the red marks are the bug's number?"
"Yes."
"Like, like a license plate?"
"More or less," Manfred said. "We haven't taken a chip of the red material for analysis yet, but we suspect it'll prove to be a ceramic material painted onto the shell or spray-bonded in some fashion."
Gavinal said,
"Somewhere there are a lot of these things industriously digging for diamonds, red diamonds, and each of them carries a coded serial number that identifies it to whomever created it and set it to work."
Bobby grappled with that concept for a moment, trying to find a way to see it as part of the world in which he lived, but it simply did not fit.
Dr. Gavinal, you're able to envision engineered creatures like this?"
"I couldn't have envisioned this," Gavinal said adamantly. "It never would have occurred to me. I could only recognize it for what it was, for what it must be."
"All right, but nevertheless you recognize what it must be, which is something neither Clint nor I could have done. So now tell me, who could make something like this damn thing?" Manfred and Gavinal exchanged a meaningful look and were both silent for a long moment, as if they knew the answer to his question but were reluctant to reveal it. Finally, lowering his game show host voice to an even more mellifluous note, Gavinal said,
"The genetic knowledge and engineering skill required to produce this thing did not yet exist. We're not even close to being able to, not even close."
Bobby said, "How long until science advances far enough to make this thing possible?"
"No way of arriving at a precise answer," Manfred said.
"Guess." "Decades," Gavinal said. "A century. Who knows?"
Clint said,
"Wait a minute. What are you telling us, that this thing comes from the future, that it came through some time warp from the next century?"
"Either that," Gavinal said, "either that, or it doesn't come from this world at all."
Stunned,
Bobby looked down at the bug with no less revulsion, but with considerably more wonder and respect than he'd had a moment ago. You really think this might be a biological machine created by people from another world? An alien artifact? Manfred worked his mouth but produced no sound, as if rendered speechless by the prospect of what he was about to say.
Yes, Gavinal said. An alien artifact. Seems more likely to me than the possibility that it came tumbling back to us through some hole in time.
Even as Gavinal spoke, Dyson Manfred continued to work his mouth in a frustrated attempt to break the silence that gripped him, and his lantern jaw gave him the look of a praying mantis masticating a grisly lunch. When the words at last issued from him, they came in a rush.
We want you to understand, we will not, flatly will not return this specimen. We'd be derelict as scientists to allow this incredible thing to reside in the hands of laymen. We must preserve and protect it, and we will, even if we have to do so by force.
A flush of defiance lent a glow of health to the entomologist's pale, angular face for the first time since Bobby had met him.
Even if by force, he repeated.
Bobby had no doubt that he and Clint could beat the crap out of the human stick bug and his rotund colleague, but there was no reason to do so. He didn't care if they kept the thing in the lab tray, as long as they agreed to some ground rules about how and when they would go public with it. All he wanted right now was to get out of that bug house into warm sunlight and fresh air. The whispery sounds from the specimen drawers, though certainly imaginary, grew louder and more frenzied by the minute. His entomophobia would soon kick him off the ledge of reason and send him screaming from the room. He wondered if his anxiety was apparent or if he was sufficiently self-controlled to conceal it. He felt a bead of sweat slip down his left temple and had the answer.
Let's be absolutely frank, Gavinal said. It's not our obligation to science that requires us to maintain possession of this specimen. A revelation of this will make us, academically and financially. Neither one of us is a slouch in his field, but this will catapult us to the top, the very top, and we're willing to do whatever is necessary to protect our interests here.
His blue eyes had narrowed, and his open Irish face had closed up into a hard mask of determination.
I'm not saying I'd kill to keep that specimen, but I'm not saying I wouldn't either.
Bobby sighed. I've done a lot of research for UCI into the backgrounds of prospective faculty members, so I know the academic world can be as competitive and vicious and dirty, dirtier than either politics or show business. I'm not going to fight you on this, but we've got to reach an agreement about when you can go public with it. I don't want you doing anything that would bring my client to the attention of the press until we've resolved his case and are sure he's out of danger.
And when will that be? Manfred asked.
Bobby shrugged. A day or two, maybe a week. I doubt it'll drag on much longer than that. The entomologist and geneticist beamed at each other, obviously delighted. Manfred said,
That's no problem at all. We'll need much longer than that to finish studying the specimen, prepare our first paper for publication, and devise a strategy to deal with both the scientific community and the media.
Bobby imagined that he heard one of the shallow drawers sliding open in the case behind him, forced outward by the weight of a vile torrent of giant squirming Madagascar roaches. But I'll take the 3 diamonds with me, he said. They're quite valuable, and they belong to my client. Manfred and Gavinal hesitated, made a token protest,
but quickly agreed. Clint took the stones and rewrapped them in the handkerchief. The scientist's capitulation convinced Bobby that there had been more than three diamonds in the bug, probably at least five, leaving them with two stones to support their thesis regarding the bug's origins and purpose.
"We'll want to meet your client, interview him," Gavinal said.
"That's up to him," Bobby said.
"It's essential. We must interview him."
"That's his decision," Bobby said. "You've gotten most of what you wanted. Eventually he may agree, and then you'll have everything you're after, but don't push it now." The round man nodded.
"Oh, fair enough, but tell me,
where did he find the thing?"
"He doesn't remember. He has amnesia."
The drawer behind him was open now. He could hear the shells of the huge roaches clicking and scraping together as they poured out of confinement and down the front of the cabinet swarming toward him.
We really have to go, he said. We don't have another minute to spare.
He left the study quickly, trying not to look as if he was bolting for his life. Clint followed him, as did the two scientists, and at the front door Manfred said,
I'm going to sound as if I ought to be writing stories for some sensational tabloid, but if this is an alien artifact that came into your client's hands, do you think he could have gotten it inside, a spaceship? Those people who claim to have been abducted and forced to undergo examinations aboard spaceships, they always seem to go through a period of amnesia first, before learning the truth.
Those people are crackpots or frauds, Gavinal said sharply. We can't let ourselves be associated with that sort of thing.
He frowned, and the frown deepened into a scowl, and he said,
Unless, in this case, it's true.
Looking back at them from the stoop, grateful to be outside, Bobby said,
Maybe it is. I'm at a point where I'll believe anything till it's disproved, but I'll tell you this. My feeling is that whatever is happening to my client is something a lot stranger than alien abduction.
A lot, Clint agreed. Without further elaboration, they went down the front walkway to the car. Bobby opened his door and stood for a moment, reluctant to get into Clint's Chevy. The mild breeze washing down the Irvine Hills felt so clean after the stale air in Manfred's study. He put one hand in his pocket, felt the three red diamonds, and said softly, Bug shit. When he finally got into the car and slammed the door, he barely resisted the urge to reach under his shirt to determine if the things he still felt crawling on him were real. Manfred and Gavinal stood on the front stoop, watching Bobby and Clint, as if half expecting their car to tip back on its rear bumper and shoot straight into the sky to rendezvous with some great glowing craft out of a Spielberg movie. Clint drove two blocks, turned at the corner, and pulled to the curb as soon as they were out of sight. Bobby, where in the hell did Frank get that thing? Bobby could only answer him with another question.
How many different places does he go when he teleports? The money, the red diamonds, and the bug, the black sand. And how far away are some of those places? Really far away?
And who is he? Clint asked.
Frank Pollard from El Encanto Heights.
But I mean, who is that?
Clint thumped one fist against the steering wheel.
Who the hell is Frank Pollard from El Encanto?
I think what you really want to know is not who he is. More important, what is he?
By surprise, Bobby came to visit. Lunch was eaten before Bobby came. Dessert was still in Thomas's mind. Not the taste of it, the memory. Vanilla ice cream, fresh strawberries. The way dessert made you feel. He was alone in his room, sitting in his armchair, thinking about making a picture poem that would have the feeling of eating ice cream and strawberries. Not the taste, but the good feeling. So someday, when you didn't have any ice cream or strawberries, you could just look at the poem and get that same good feeling, even without eating anything. Of course, you couldn't use pictures of ice cream or strawberries in the poem, because that wouldn't be a poem. That would only be saying how good ice cream and strawberries made you feel. A poem didn't just say, it showed you and made you feel. Then Bobby came through the door, and Thomas was so happy he forgot the poem, and they hugged. Somebody was with Bobby, but it wasn't Julie, so Thomas was disappointed. He was embarrassed, too, because it turned out he'd met the person with Bobby a couple of times before over the years, but he didn't remember him right away, which made him feel dumb. It was Clint, Thomas said the name to himself over and over, so maybe he'd remember next time. Clint, 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 Clint. Julie couldn't come, Bobby said. She's babysitting a client. Thomas wondered why a baby would ever need a private eye, but he didn't ask. In TV, only grown-ups needed private eyes, which were called private eyes because they looked out for you, though he wasn't sure why they were called private. He also wondered how a baby could pay for a private eye, because he knew eyes like Bobby and Julie worked for money like everyone else, but babies didn't work. They were too little to do anything. So where'd this one get the money to pay Bobby and Julie? He hoped they didn't get cheated out of their money. They worked hard for it. Bobby said, "She told me to tell you she loves you even more than she did yesterday, and she'll love you even more tomorrow." They hugged again, because this time Thomas was giving the hug to Bobby for Julie. Clint asked to see the latest scrapbook of poems. He took it across the room and sat in Derek's armchair, which was okay because Derek wasn't in it. He was in the rec room. Bobby moved the chair from the work table, putting it closer to the armchair that belonged to Thomas. He sat, and they talked about what a big blue day it was and how nice the flowers looked when they were all bright outside Thomas's window. For a while, they talked about a lot of things, and Bobby was funny. Except when they talked about Julie, he changed. He was worried about Julie, you could tell. When he talked about her, he was like a good picture poem. He didn't say his worry, but he showed it and made you feel it. Thomas was already worried for Julie, so Bobby's worry made him feel even worse, made him scared for her. "We've got our hands full with the current case," Bobby said, "so neither one of us might be able to visit again until this weekend or the first of the week." "Okay, sure," Thomas said, and a big coldness rushed in from somewhere and filled him up. Each time Bobby mentioned the new case, the one with the baby, his picture poem of worry was even easier to read. Thomas wondered if this was the case where they were going to meet up with the bad thing. He was pretty sure it was. He thought he should tell Bobby about the bad thing, but he couldn't find a way. No matter how he told it, he'd sound like the dumbest dumb person who ever lived at the home. It was better to wait until the danger was coming a lot nearer. Then TV to Bobby a real hard warning that'd scare him into looking out for the bad thing and shooting it when he saw it. Bobby would pay attention to a TV'd warning because he wouldn't know where it came from, that it came from just a dumb person. And Bobby could shoot, too. All private eyes could shoot because most days it was bad out there in the world, and you knew you were going to meet up with somebody who was going to shoot at you first or try to run you down with a car or stab you or strangle you or once in a while try to throw you off a building or even try to make it look like suicide. And since most good guys didn't carry guns around with them, private eyes who watched over them had to be good shooters. After a while, Bobby had to go. Not to the bathroom, but back to work. So they hugged again, and then Bobby and Clint were gone, and Thomas was alone. He went to the window, looked out. The day was good, better than night. But even with the sun pushing most darkness out past the edge of the world, and even with the rest of the darkness hiding from the sun behind trees and buildings, there was badness in the day. The bad thing hadn't gone out past the edge of the world with the night. It was still there somewhere in the day, you could tell. Last night, when he got too close to the bad thing and it tried to grab him, he was so afraid he pulled away quick-like. He had a feeling the bad thing was trying to find out who he was and